Talk Radio's November episode. This month, in the spirit of Thanksgiving, all of our segments explore the connection between food and family. First, Allison and Sarah speak with Mari Omland, who is a co-owner of Green Mountain Girls Farm, located in Northfield, Vermont. Mari emphasizes the importance of cultivating not just food, but relationships with the food we eat and the people we eat it with. Next, Katie talks with a fellow first-year law student, Jenny Knernshield, about the difficulties Jenny's family faced when trying to use the vegetables they grew in their garden to make the dishes served at their family restaurant. In our third segment, Angel investigates what impact the Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010 has had on the South Royalton School lunch program.
Hello and welcome to November's edition of Food Talk Radio's Food and Agriculture News. This is Emily Lane and
Natalie Kaleo, and here are this month's global, national, and local news headlines.
Coming from the 2014 Farm Bill, the Whole Farm Revenue Protection Insurance Policy will be piloted beginning in fiscal year 2015. This new insurance policy will allow small to mid-sized farmers to insure all of their crops and livestock under one insurance policy instead of separate policies for each commodity. Dow was authorized this month to use Enlist Duo in 6 states, clearing the way for the sales of corn and soybeans, which are genetically engineered to tolerate the herbicide. Dow Chairman and Chief Executive Officer Andrew Liveris is counting on Enlist Duo to help double the earnings of Dow AgriSciences in the next 5 to 7 years. Enlist Duo is a combination of the herbicides 2,4-D and glyphosate. It was created to compete with Monsanto's popular Roundup Ready, which kills weeds using glyphosate. The approval has already been challenged for its legality. The Center for Food Safety filed lawsuit in the United States Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco on behalf of Beyond Pesticides, the Center for Biological Diversity, the Center for Food Safety, Environmental Working Group, and the National Family Farm Coalition, as well as Pesticide Action Network North America. The groups are challenging the approval under the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, commonly known as FIFRA, arguing that the EPA did not adequately analyze the impacts of 2,4-D on human health. They will also argue that the approval violated the Endangered Species Act, as there was no consult by the EPA with the Fish and Wildlife Service. According to the New York Times October 14th article, Risks of Cheap Water, the price of water going into American homes does not cover the cost of delivering it, let alone the depreciation of utilities' infrastructure or their research and development. It further does not account for other costs imposed by water use, for example, damage to fisheries or the environment caused by taking waters out of rivers or lakes. The author, Eduardo Porter, says consumers have little incentive to conserve and explains why. Despite California's distress, about half of the homes in the capital, Sacramento, still don't have water meters. They pay a flat fee regardless of how much water they consume. Their water rights are primarily subject to state law. In the West, they've been allocated by a method that closely resembles first-come, first-served. The first farm that drew water had the right to whatever it needed. Junior users, who arrive later, have to stand in line. Farmers pay if the government brings water to the farm, say, through an aqueduct from the Colorado River, but the fees are minimal. Farmers in California's Imperial Irrigation District pay $20 per acre foot, less than a tenth of what it can cost in San Diego, and the government has often subsidized farmers through things like interest-free loans to cover upfront investments. This kind of arrangement helps explain why about half of the 60 million acres of irrigated land in the United States use flood irrigation, which is just flooding the fields with water. It helps explain why underground water reserves declined by 53 million acre feet between 2003 and 2014, about twice the volume of Lake Mead. The United States Environmental Protection Agency is getting pressure from environment and sustainable agriculture organizations, as well as members of Congress, to investigate and restrict the use of neonicotinoids, a class of pesticides linked to declining pollinator populations. Neonicotinoids are being cited as one of several factors contributing to colony collapse disorder in bees. leading to sharp population decline in recent years. In the past year, the abrupt reduction of pollinator members has led to two-year bans on neonicotinoids in Europe, a class action lawsuit from beekeepers in Canada, and a federal strategy outlined by the Obama administration to promote pollinator health.
In international news, on October 16th, it was World Food Day, and the focus was on family farming. The United Nations has designated 2014 the International Year of Family Farming, and this year's World Food Day theme was created as a reflection of this sentiment. According to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, this October 16th theme intended to focus attention on the significant role of family farming in eradicating hunger and poverty, providing food security and nutrition, improving livelihoods, managing natural resources, protecting the environment, and achieving sustainable development, particularly in rural areas. A study performed in Munich has found evidence suggesting that infants who are fed using farm fresh milk, as opposed to commercially sold ultra-pasteurized or UHT milk, are less susceptible to various illnesses, including respiratory infections, head colds, and middle ear inflammation. According to the researchers, the child's risk of developing these illnesses was reduced by up to 30%. The authors, however, do not promote the use of raw milk, but rather promote alternative methods of processing. The results of this study were published in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology. The sea has long been a source of Norway's riches, whether from cod, farmed salmon, or oil. Now one researcher hopes to add seaweed to this list as he refines a way to produce biocrude from common kelp. Biocrude is a synthetic fuel which can be used as a replacement for petroleum. According to the researcher, they are trying to mimic the natural processes in order to produce oil, but while petroleum oil is produced naturally on a geological timescale, the researchers are able to produce oil in minutes. Antibiotic use in the rapidly expanding world of global aquaculture has been examined in a new study. Results of this research evaluated the presence of antibiotics in shrimp, salmon, catfish, trout, tilapia, and swine, originating from 11 countries. Data has shown traces of 5 out of the 47 antibiotics evaluated. Oxytetracycline, the most commonly used antibiotic in aquaculture, was most prevalent in the study samples. And in local news, Ben & Jerry's ice cream flavor, Hazed and Confused, has come under some scrutiny with individuals complaining that the flavor name is insensitive to victims of college hazing. Ben & Jerry's has declined to change the name, explaining that the name is a reference to the Led Zeppelin song and the 1993 cult classic movie, Dazed and Confused. The Vermont Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets, in conjunction with the Northeast Association of State Departments of Agriculture, will host an open listening session on November 17th to offer farmers and food processors an opportunity to provide comment on new supplemental rules proposed by the Federal Food Safety Modernization Act. On October 23rd, Vermont's Farm to Plate Initiative met for a conference at Killington on food equity issues. The group's stated goal is to strengthen the role of local food in Vermont's economy and communities. According to the group, Vermont's food system has grown to $1.7 billion of new economic activity in just 5 years, but 1 out of 7 children in the state are considered food insecure. The group discussed underlying problems identified by migrant workers and looked for solutions for change. International food activist and author Vandana Shiva spoke about the role of Vermont's GMO labeling law as a part of the global solution to transform food systems and reverse climate crisis during a lecture at Vermont Law School campus on November 3rd. On October 19th, Rich and Cynthia Larson hosted an open barn party at the Larson Farm. The party was open to all ages and included education and entertainment opportunities. The past two open barn parties have focused on raw milk, specifically celebrating the change to Vermont's raw milk law this past summer, which allows Tier 2 farmers to deliver milk to farmers markets.
If you are passionate about supporting small farms and local food systems and thriving rural communities, then you should get involved with Rural Vermont. Rural Vermont is an advocacy nonprofit based in Montpelier, and the organization works to be sure there are fair policies for farmers, so that consumers have access to healthy and sustainable food. If you are interested in an internship, volunteering, or becoming a member of Rural Vermont, check out www.ruralvermont.org. This is Allison and Sarah with Mari from Green Mountain Girls Farm in Northfield, Vermont.
How and why did you decide on the free choice model of CSA?
We want to be in relationship with our customers. So the free choice allows people to choose their own package each week. What do I want to bring home to the farm? It allows them to really make the farm theirs and us be their farm.
What are your CSA customer demographics? Are they more families or more single adults?
Interesting. We've had a pretty good balance of both, and it's quite fun, whether family or single adult, to hear the exchanges that happen around the pickup. People that have a new recipe and, you know, have learned that so-and-so is making cheese. And there's quite a few, a handful of families that have been with us from the beginning, and some of them have very young children, and some have had kids go through high school and on to college. And it's kind of fun to hear the families report that the college kids, you know, when they're going to visit, they want, you know, something specific from mm-hmm. the farm. So we, in a way, we really are watching these families grow up. Some of these families come almost weekly. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of just coming with one person to pick up the food, they'll come as a family, and the kids will snack on carrots. You know, someone will run out and see their favorite pig. So if one comes to the farm for a farm share pickup on Thursday evening, we're sharing not only the food that's on offer that week, but we're sharing the farm on Thursday evenings with those that pick up.
So how often do these families take advantage of that and get to know your farm, walk around it when they come here for their pickup?
Yeah, you know, some families really, again, make it a mainstay of their week. And you know, others, you know, specifically love the goat kids. And during the spring, they'll come and see the goat kids, you know, 6 weeks in a row. And then when they go off to pasture, maybe they don't have time to chase mm-hmm. down the farm road and see where they've
right.
where they've grown up to be. But it's you know, a few families, you watch them get too busy with a new baby, but then the baby gets bigger and they're back out and seeing the animals. So, it, you know, there's a few people that take advantage of it regularly, and then there's some people who seem to cherish the option but never do.
How would you recommend families build a connection with their farmers and teach their kids about where their food is coming from?
You know, I think every farm is different, mm-hmm. and the invitation to participate will be different in each place. And when you're searching for a farm to be part of, look at that. And you know, some places actually have bigger pick-your-own sections, and some places have no pick-your-own. And just sort of pay attention to what it is your family's seeking and make sure that's on your list when you're shopping. So you might be, you know, in our case, you could look at our website and see week after week, all the way back for years, what's been on offer in April. Am I going to join a year-round farm share? I don't know. But the same thing as you might go to a farm and say, you know, how often do you have salad greens? You may want to say, you know, how often do you have an event where my mm-hmm. family can participate in a hands-on way, mm-hmm. or what other, you know, what's safe and within bounds for me as a farm share member to do around the farm. And for some, it'll be easy to accommodate, you know, more robust farm experiences. And then for others, there'll be limitations, whether it be from, you know, a safety perspective or just preferences of the farmer. Mm-hmm. But ask questions, have dialogue. Same thing we've got to do to find out about our food. You know, find out about, is this a place where the learning style of my family and kids mm-hmm. will be supported?
This is Katie with Food Talk Radio, and today I'm with...
My name's Jenny Kinnernshield.
And she's another VLS law student, and today we're talking with Jenny because her family operates a restaurant, and I was hoping you could tell us what type of restaurant your family operates and give us a little background on the restaurant.
Yeah, I'm from Missouri, and my mom is from Thailand, and in 2007, we got the opportunity to take over a little carryout stand from another Thai woman. She'd had it for about a year, and her kids were going off to school. And she decided, you know, I went out of this. So the day she put up a for sale sign, my mother, the only other Thai woman within 100 miles, walked in and decided, oh, this is going to be a great investment.
Earlier, you were telling me about issues that your family ran into when they tried to use produce that you guys were growing yourself in the dishes at the restaurant. So maybe could you talk about those issues?
Yeah, my mom had always been an avid gardener. Like, she loves gardening. She does more potted plants and very, very small gardens, but she still lovingly calls it her farm. While we didn't do things like green peppers or onions or carrots or anything like that, we would do herbs like basil and cilantro. And my mom really liked bringing in her seasonal stuff, so like butternut squashes and pumpkins. And then one of the issues we ran into is our health inspector came in and was bothered that we couldn't show where the herbs and vegetables were coming from, whereas we had receipts for all of our other stuff. And so they just asked us not to use it. And we didn't for a while, even though our health inspector didn't really have any sort of regulations or handouts on the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, you have to understand, like, we're from a very small town in Missouri, very rural. And we are the only ethnic restaurant for hours. So all the other places were burger joints, places that could order their stuff and it would come in a truck in a bag and they could just boil it and serve it, things like that. So our health inspector really had no idea how to deal with us because we were making stuff. It just, I guess as an example, is we make our own crab rangoons, and they wanted to know why the crab rangoons didn't come pre-made so we could just drop them into a fryer. Yeah. And we started talking to, I mean, again, this is small town Missouri.
Yeah, yeah.
So our insurance guy, we were talking to him, and he said, you know, there's not really, I mean, I don't want you to go in the face of your health inspector, but it's really interesting, you know, when I go into bigger cities, you know, this was 2007, I guess at this point it was probably 2008, farm-to-table really hadn't hit mid-Missouri, rural Missouri yet.
Yeah, it was interesting.
You know, my bigger city clients, St. Louis, Kansas City, they don't really have as much of a problem with this.
Mm-hmm.
And so my mom just kept doing herbs. Like, that was the thing that was hardest for us to get. None of our suppliers could get us fresh basil in the middle of winter.
Okay.
Which makes sense. And even in the summer, our basil was coming from San Francisco, had to stop in Chicago to be repacked, sent to our supplier in St. Louis, and then driven to us. So it was like,
I mean, that's just hours and days. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's one thing that we started incorporating. And our health inspector, since he didn't really have a rule against it, just sort of was like, well, we'll try this out to see if we get in any trouble. And he realized, you know, we were being smart with our food. We weren't just, like, setting it on the ground or washing it or anything. And I think it just clicked with them that they had never had an issue with having to assess fresh food.
Yeah, that makes sense. So then your mom was able, well, your whole family could still use the herbs in the dishes. And did you keep using the vegetables, too?
Yeah. Well, yes and no. But it's not because we couldn't. It's because eventually the restaurant grew so big, we couldn't produce enough.
Okay.
And so if we offered pumpkin, we could offer pumpkin to five people. And I'm saying, like, pumpkin Thai food. We had, like, pumpkin curries and stuff. But until recently, because my mom made a friend with a little Filipina who it just bothered her that she came from the Philippines where there's small plots and fresh fruit vegetables everywhere. And so now this woman has her own small farm, and she'll bring in enough that we can make stuff every now and then.
Just out of curiosity, did anyone ever, like, have to look at your mom, like, where she was growing the herbs, or was that they didn't have to worry about that?
That's something that we were worried about, but the health inspector wasn't worried about.
Okay.
I think because they could see the condition of where it was kept. Like, where, I mean, when it's
once
in the restaurant.
Once it already,
like,
got to the restaurant.
Yeah, like how clean it is in the restaurant and how we were keeping it there, because, you know, we kept it. I would say we kept it to our standards, which were above health standards.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Since, you know, my whole family eats out of the restaurant, too. yeah, so it never became an issue. She did do a window garden just at work for lemongrass.
Oh, okay.
And So the health inspector did see that, and he thought it was interesting because he'd never had to inspect a garden.
Oh, that's funny.
And so, but that was fine. It passed.
That's cool. It sounds like your guys' restaurant is really awesome for where you're at.
Yeah, it's really unique. And the name of it's Walk and Roll. So I think a lot of people drive by. I guess I should have said that at the beginning.
Oh, it's fine.
A lot of people are like, oh, Walk and Roll. I know a Walk and Roll in Illinois, and it's terrible. So Walk and Roll is not a trademarked name. Like every state has probably got 50 Walk and Rolls.
Walk and Rolls.
It was an inherited name.
Is there anything else had to deal with since your mom bought the restaurant?
I guess it's really interesting. My parents and I never thought of ourselves as being, it's not quite a food desert, but relative to what we were making, like the dishes we're making,
mm-hmm.
there's a reason why there weren't any restaurants out there. At first, we were taking trips. St. Louis and Kansas City are about 3 hours away from us, one way. So once a week, we had to make a trip to go to a bigger city to get supplies, and that would be rarer vegetables, spices, herbs,
mm-hmm.
because we couldn't find a grocer probably for the first 3 years that would actually drive to us, other than the main staples like carrots and onions. And we found that we couldn't use a restaurant supplier. We had to use a grocery supplier instead.
Why was that?
Suppliers, they didn't have a demand. So the only thing they could offer us were like chicken strips and pre-made burgers and buns and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it took a really long time. The restaurant's in its seventh year.
Mm-hmm.
Probably about 3 years, we had to use the grocery suppliers. We finally got a restaurant supplier, but the only thing we were buying from them were meat. And we were still using the grocery suppliers. And then we finally found an Asian grocer, one of the people that we went to in St. Louis all the time. They said, mm-hmm. you know what, you come up here once a month. We have a truck that gets within an hour of you. We'll just promise to order a crazy amount of food, which we do now. We'll stop. So it was a really long time finding someone to supply to us.
Thank you for talking with us, and I'm happy that you guys still get to use the herbs that you grow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Welcome, everyone. This is Angel Rayford of Vermont Law School, here today with Linda Wheelock, Food Services Manager for South Royalton School and President-Elect of the School Nutrition Association Vermont Chapter. Thank you for joining us today.
Hello.
This month, our program is focused on family and food. I thought a good topic would be the highly publicized changes in school lunches. Several reports have claimed that currently in the United States, 1 in 3 children are obese. To help this cause, Mrs. Obama continues to spread the word about new and healthy lifestyle choices with her Let's Move campaign. Meanwhile, President Obama has also sought to help with the obesity epidemic in children when he signed into law the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010, which is an amendment of the Child Nutrition Act of 1966. While both President and Mrs. Obama seem to want to have a positive impact on the health of our children, they have experienced some backlash, with students from around the country using the hashtag #ThanksMichelle to show their dissatisfaction with the new food standards. Some of these new food standards found in the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010 include a requirement to take a fruit or vegetable during breakfast and lunch, only serving low-fat milk and non-fat milk during breakfast and lunch. Water must be available during lunch. There's a weekly vegetable subgroup requirement that must be met. And there's a requirement that all grains are 50% whole grain rich foods. Thank you so much for joining me in your cafeteria. I just wanted to talk about a few of the issues concerning this new act and how it's affected you and your lunch program. So I wanted to start with, how long does it take to formulate a lunch menu for the year?
Actually, I would say in a monthly, I go month by month. I don't plan for the whole year. It takes me about a good 8 hours to plan a 1 month of menus. That's breakfast, lunch, and supper.
And do you use a team, or do you make this wonderful lunch menu on your own?
I'm on my own.
What kind of things do you take into consideration when creating a lunch menu?
First and foremost, I have to make sure I'm not going over my calories, my fat, my sodium counts for the week. And I need to make sure I'm meeting my vegetable subgroups. Then after that, I can be creative. I look into what do we have available in our commodity allotment from the federal government. What is the cost of the item, and what is student popularity and familiarity? Mm-hmm. And try to sometimes bring in some of the local ingredients and or fresh ingredients to try to give the kids some new items to try once in a while as well.
And so when you say food commodity items, these are items that the government is requiring you to use, or that they are restricting you from using? Is that what you mean when you say that?
No, there's the commodity program where it's donated foods that comes from the government and that is given to us to help us with our the cost of our program. Unfortunately, it's only 12 to 16% of the food that we bring into the cafeteria on a yearly basis.
So, have you had to overcome any obstacles when it comes to the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010?
It's been difficult changing habits, getting kids to embrace whole grain pastas. The whole grain breads might be a little more accepted. Brown rice, that's pretty well been accepted across the board, but there's just some items like the pasta that's really been difficult. And then getting kids to take a fruit or vegetable with the meal, if they're not going to consume that fruit or vegetable, has been really difficult. It's very frustrating because we had made a very strong move toward cooking from scratch here for many years, and it is very limiting. Some of the things that I'm hearing from more than one colleague is that if you take a raw chicken tender and bread it yourself, obviously you're giving your students a better quality product because you're cooking from scratch. But as far as the federal government is concerned, you don't have a nutritional analysis done on that the way you've prepared it. And so now it's basically forcing us to buy something in a brown box coming off of a truck.
Have any kids complained about their healthy lunches here?
I do see some students who would much rather bring a lunch from home, but that's been across the board from the get-go. Honestly, I saw a little bit of a decrease the first year that this program was implemented, but now I'm seeing an upward climb again in the participation of the lunch meals.
I heard a bell. Is that the supper bell?
That's the supper bell.
So I guess all the children are coming in now for their third meal of the day here
third
at South
meal.
Royalton School. Well, that is so wonderful. It's a great service that you're doing to the children of South Royalton, and I see a couple of them in here now. All right, well, I would like to thank you so much for joining me today. I appreciate you giving us a little bit of insight on the Healthy Hunger Kids Free Act of 2010 and letting us know what it takes to make a lunch menu, and so thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That does it for today's show. Enjoy your November and have a great Thanksgiving. The next episode of Food Talk Radio will air Tuesday, November 2nd at 11 a.m. here on Royalton Community Radio. This episode of Food Talk Radio was produced by Emily Lane, Natalie Kaleo, Allison Erlas, Sarah Danley, Katie Davis, Angel Rayford, Heather Devine, and Coral Skeen. Our faculty advisor is Lori Restino. Make sure to follow us on Twitter @VT Food Radio and like our Facebook page. Playing us out today is Nate Ruby with his song, The Woods.
Can you